Zahra, let me ask you, do you feel that there's a direct connection to Trump's rhetoric and hate crimes against Muslims?
Yes. What we've seen, unfortunately,
what's
in the last...
What's the evidence that you see that?
So America saw, people in America saw that someone who was openly racist, misogynist, Islamophobic, and so on, could win the presidency. And unfortunately, his rhetoric, the rhetoric of his advisors, has validated people who might not have otherwise come out of their homes to commit violence.
Oh my goodness. I watched this. Why was I watching this over the weekend? You know why? Because I think it was Sunday. Yeah, it was yesterday. I got home from a bunch of meetings and was on Fox News on Sunday, and then I like to sort of turn on, like flip through cable to see what they're talking about, and I see this woman from the Council on American Islamic Relations come on, and she just seemed really angry, and throwing around all of these horrible insults about Donald Trump and his selection so far for the cabinet. Racist, sexist, misogynist, Islamophobic, all the obics and all the isms. She threw them all out there. And unchallenged by the host, of course. And this was after the host had another woman on who was Muslim, who was urging reform. She writes for the Daily Beast, and we're going to try to get her on as well. But it was quite something. And you know what they do is they rely on the Southern Poverty Law Center's statistics. You've heard of that group. It's cited like it's the gospel. Guess what? The FBI has now ceased using the Southern Poverty Law Center as a valid arbiter of hate crimes, the numbers for hate crimes. Why? I looked into it over the weekend. Which, by the way, they've trashed people like me and Bridget Gabriel and others and put us on these like anti-Muslim hit lists, which are being used as hit lists by the jihadists, by the way. You know they are. They're going to look up these things and try to target people. It's very dangerous what they do. And so... you know what they do for hate crimes? They do look at some police reports, but they also look at social media for evidence of hate crimes, and they look at just random emails that come in with no way to verify the veracity of the complaints. So if the FBI is no longer using the Southern Poverty Law Center as an independent, trustworthy voice on the hate crimes ledger, then why should all these other people be citing it? And why should they be using their, quote, lists of the, quote, offenders of all these isms, homophobia or Islamophobia, whatever? Why should they be considered the gold standard? It's ridiculous. It's become a partisan organization masquerading as a nonprofit. You got to explain exactly what they're all about and the people on their board and what they represent, et cetera, et cetera. But this kept going on and on and on with this young woman from the Council on American Islamic Relations.
We've seen a spike in the last 18 months and then also just in the last 10 days. Over 100 anti-Muslim incidents across the country, right? And it's individuals who are being targeted in parking lots, children, college students, adults. Right now, it's happening everywhere.
All right, Zahra Abilah from the Council on American Islamic Relations. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm sure this is a conversation that will continue.
Yeah, the nice way to counter her. That was a host on MSNBC who's interviewing this Sahara Ballou. Is that her name? Ballou? Ballou. So that's where we are. Dr. Kanta Ahmed is the Associate Professor of Medicine at... State University of New York, Stony Brook, and has some interesting things to say about Islamism versus Islam and how, well, there basically needs to be a reformation in order to, you know, get a handle on this, increasing extremism and radicalism and the Islamists that are, frankly, gaining power across the globe. And Dr. Ahmed joins us now. Dr. Ahmed, great to talk to you. How are you?
Good, thank you. And your discussion just now was particularly fascinating. That exactly exemplifies how hard it is for Muslims like me to talk about Islamism. I know Asra Nomani, I saw that clip that you referred to on MSNBC as well. She was next to me when I testified at the King hearings 4 years ago in 2012, arguing that we do need to look at domestic radicalization here in the United States. And I was met with many of the same tone. I've been given speeches about Islamism at a university in New Jersey, in Rutgers, where Muslims in the crowd have accused me of stoking Islamophobia. So firstly, I like to call, if there is a hate crime directed at any individual in the United States, that's unacceptable, and we have enforcement that looks after that. But if it's directed at a Muslim, I call it xenophobia. That's very important, because Islamophobia as a term has been driven by Islamist Iran. The first example of that is what happened to Salman Rushdie. The whole goal of using Islamophobia is to eliminate scrutiny on actions conducted in the name of Islam. And that serves only one purpose. That serves to strengthen Islamism. For your listeners who are well informed, by Islamism, I mean the political totalitarian ideology, an ideology shared by Hamas, Hezbollah, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, that seeks to subvert our systems of democracy around the world. It has features that are completely anathema to principles of Islam, the religion that I observe, which advocates charity, worship, visiting Mecca, believing in one God. They are absolutely distinct, but Islamism likes to hide amongst us. And Muslims who are uninformed or they are sympathizers of Islamism are the ones that least want to have this discussion. And that's why it's necessary.
Mm-hmm. So how did you become such a really persuasive advocate for exposing what Islamism is and what it does to young minds and how it's being propagated through Iran?
Great
how did
question.
You become so into it?
Great question. I mean, one of the founding principles of being a Muslim, the bare minimum of one's faith, is to expose injustice. That's one of the requirements of being a Muslim. And like anybody else, I was very affected by September 11th, which I witnessed from Saudi Arabia, where I was practicing medicine then. And I just began to wonder, how are these things happening in the name of my religion, which in my family meant that I was an educated woman holding wealth. My mother is a physician who did the same.
Wow.
How can this happen? And that became the nidus for me to first describe what was happening to me in Saudi Arabia, where I was immobilized in the name of religion. I could not drive. I did experience gender apartheid. I could do all kinds of technical advanced things on my critically ill patients, just like I would do here in New York. But I had no autonomy, and I was treated legally as a minor. This is done in the name of Islam, yet it was completely unfamiliar to my entire Muslim family and me. After that, I wrote a book, which people can read about, what it's like to live and work as a woman in Saudi Arabia. And I naturally began to be curious about terrorism happening in the name of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
That led me to learn about Islamism, to learn about Hamas and Hezbollah. That took me, therefore, 8 times to the State of Israel, where I have learned from experts in counterterrorism. It also took me to Pakistan's northwest frontier, where I met with Pakistani military soldiers fighting jihadists. I've become deeply concerned, and I feel it's my job, if I'm good at explaining things, to get the truth out there.
That's
and
amazing.
Therefore, this is why I said, and it's so kind of you to watch, that regardless of all this hysteria circulating about what President Trump-elect might do, we have a fresh opportunity to dissect one of the most confounding problems the world is facing, and that is Islamism. And the first way to do that is to create a space where we can have these discussions. Bear in mind, there are very few nations in the world where this can be done. And bear in mind, the United States provides safe harbor and shelter to Muslims of all denominations, something that you cannot say about most Muslim majority countries. So I think to the world, the United States has a unique responsibility to unveil Islamism, which only empowers Muslims.
Nice turn of phrase, by the way, Doctor. Unveil Islamism. Can I ask you, I mean, some of these questions might seem a bit facile or not, I mean, they might seem obvious to you, but I know my listeners would be interested in some of them. What I find to be hard to fathom is how someone who is an educated woman who went to top schools, I'm not talking about you, but in general, would then submit to wear a full burqa with just a tiny little slit for the eyes. I mean, that wasn't required by Islam. That's a modern affectation and demand on women in Islam. Isn't that correct?
Yeah. First of all, the veil that you're describing, I think you're describing a burqa like we see Afghani women wearing.
Right. Exactly.
Afghanistan or in Saudi Arabia, which is called a niqab.
In Georgetown, in Washington, D.C., and in New York, yes, where we just walked down the street, two women in burqas. Thank you very much.
I'll tell you how new this phenomenon is. The first time I saw a veiled woman, I was 7 years old with my father outside Harrods in London. I mean, that's the scene in Knightsbridge. And he pointed out a lady with a face veil on because I had never seen one. And this is my father, a Muslim father. This is very much a new construction. There are certain teachings in Islam about veiling. And guess what? They apply to men and women. It's about the veiling of our demeanor to the unrelated opposite gender. There's no specificity for a cloth. But my opinion, and it's strictly my opinion, you can't say it's evidence-based, is that there is a resurgence in adopting the hijab, the niqab, the veil. I've seen it in Britain in the last 15 years.
Oh,
I've
totally.
Seen it here in New York. And this, to me, it's a symbol of a militancy du jour. And that will make many Muslims very angry. I have grandmothers who are deceased who always used to cover their hair, but in a very different way. And so it doesn't mean we should suspect every veiled or hijabed woman of being militant. But to some degree, it is about political identity. It is about separating yourself from the secular West, even though you're in the secular West. I mean, I'm speaking to you from my office. I'm wearing a white coat to my knees. My hair is uncovered, long sleeves. In my opinion and my family's opinion, I'm fully veiled, but I don't have a covering on my hair. And that's what's changed. Even in Saudi Arabia, I knew women who were my age, then in their 30s, now in our 40s. Their mothers had never worn veils.
Right.
It was imposed on them. It was imposed on them after the 1979 siege in Mecca.
Right.
And this rush to Islamicize. You're very well informed,
so,
if you knew that. That is where it came from.
Dr. Ahmed, so there are many people at the Council on American Islamic Relations, which has its own difficulties, just to say it nicely, in its past connection with Muslim Brotherhood, unindicted co-conspirator, and I believe terrorism. Andy McCarthy has written about this ad nauseum. He's an expert on this. But nevertheless, they send their people out on television and they quote all these statistics, a lot of it from Southern Poverty Law Center, about all these anti-Muslim actions. And I'm sure there are some, and they should be decried, and they should be prosecuted if criminal, just like any bullying or criminal activity against Trump people or Christians, same deal. But what do you think of their tactics in the media, how CARE operates?
You know, I've only encountered them on television in various segments. One of the ways I encountered them is when they accused screening of a movie I was an expert in called The Honor Diaries as an Islamophobic action. And our movie was about portraying many women in the field combating honor violence, which is, in principle, very, very, very much Islamic. I noticed that they discouraged scrutiny of Islamism. I noticed that they breed or promote a feeling that Muslims in America are under siege or Islam is under siege. And it is completely counter to the data. If you look at Pew data on Muslims, we are mainstream and middle class. Many of us are very high earning. We are very rapidly socially mobile. It doesn't mean, as you acknowledge, that there's not discrimination happening, but we have good mechanisms for it. And I think what needs to happen is let them engage in the media. I have no objection to that. Islamism is strongest only when it's in opposition. But if you scrutinize it and challenge it, particularly Muslims ourselves do this, they rapidly begin to crumble. And I think that needs to happen. President Obama, in his best efforts, this became extremely difficult. These are just discussions that were not properly had, and that provides a misleading and uneven impression.
Dr. Ahmed, I'd love to have you back and have an even longer conversation about this. I know so many Muslim professional women are just amazing people, and you're one of them. Gosh, you're well-spoken. My goodness, you speak in full paragraphs. I love it. Thank you so much for joining us. Come back soon, okay?
I would love to. Thank you. And don't forget, Muslim professional women are the daughters of Muslim men.
Of course.
That's as well as women. So I really.
I'm just promoting women right now, Dr. Ahmed. Just promoting. I gotcha. No, a fair point. We really appreciate your joining us. The conversation continues. Stay with us.
The Laura Ingraham Show.